Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we open with some national news. Local Congressman Duncan Hunter has come out in favor of a preemptive strike against North Korea. We'll have reactions on today's show. Meanwhile, North Korea has announced that it considers Donald Trump's inflammatory speech to the United Nations a declaration of war. Congress is coming together in a rare bipartisan moment for a Wildfire Disaster Funding Act. Learn more on today's show. California's Secretary of State has announced that Homeland Security says Russia succeeded in scanning California's election system during the election season. Here in El Cajon, the son of legendary boxer Archie Moore was in town for a million punches from the heart, helping disadvantaged youths. The National Weather Service warns that fire weather is here, along with Santa Ana winds. In our local government report today, we'll have a preview of what's on the La Mesa City Council coming up, including measures on affordable housing, pot smoking, and ferret ownership. And hear about an event coming up with Nile Sisters on the Sudan refugee crisis and how that impacts folks here in San Diego. California has a new state dinosaur, and we'll tell you all about it today. Then on the second half of our show, we'll be re-airing one of our favorite segments, taking you on the road to Julian, San Diego's historic gold rush town. From Public News Service, we'll have some top national headlines, including President Trump expanding travel restrictions to include 8 countries, healthcare cuts impacting children, and protests over tax measures proposed in Congress. We'll have some fall planting tips for gardeners, tell you about a proposed ban on smoking marijuana in your car, and a popular local coffee shop and open mic night venue in La Mesa that's now closed. Plus, hear why a new county library kiosk in Boulevard won't be opening anytime soon. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Gene Carpenter with a Capitol Report. In an interview aired on KUSI, Congressman Duncan D. Hunter, a Republican whose district includes much of San Diego and East County, repeatedly called for the United States to launch an attack on North Korea in response to nuclear threats. Hunter, a combat veteran and member of the House Armed Services Committee, noted that years of negotiations with North Korea have failed while the country has continued to develop its nuclear program, recently launching missiles over Japan. He told KUSI, "You could assume right now that we have a nuclear missile aimed at the United States and here in San Diego." Then added, "We could be under direct fire from the North Koreans." Hunter further stated, "I would preemptively strike them. You could call it declaring war, call it whatever you want, by preemptively striking them and taking them out. I personally think that's the only thing that's going to get them to not have the nuclear missiles aimed at the United States." North Korea's leader has made repeated threats to launch nuclear weapons at the U.S., most recently threatening Guam. He is believed to have recently succeeded in miniaturizing nuclear weapons capable of fitting onto a missile warhead, though it's unknown how accurate the aim would be. But experts disagree over how far a nuclear warhead launched from Korea could travel, though some have indicated that much of the U.S. could be within reach. In an inflammatory United Nations address this week, President Donald Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea and called its leader Rocket Man. Trump later tweeted, "Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is obviously a madman who doesn't mind starving or killing his people, will be tested like never before." Hunter called President Donald Trump's UN speech really great. Hunter's call for a first strike on North Korea drew swift response from opponents in both the Republican and Democratic Party who have announced intentions to challenge Hunter for his seat in next year's election. Andrew Zelt, a Republican and sheriff's sergeant running against Hunter, told East County Magazine that Congressman Hunter's statement calling for a preemptive strike on North Korea shows a poor display of rationality and leadership. Zelt adds, Secretary Mattis himself has already explained to the American people before about the steep price a war with North Korea would have. Millions of innocent South Koreans' lives would be caught in the crosshairs of such a war. Zelt says that North Korea should be dealt with in a strong tone and understand that, quote, the full might of the United States military will come down on them if they attack either of us or one of our allies. However, a preemptive strike is not an option. Thankfully, Mr. Hunter is not the one making these decisions, the Republican candidate concluded. Josh Buttner, a Democratic challenger, aiming to win Hunter's seat, is a retired Navy SEAL lieutenant commander. He issued this statement. Having served in the SEAL teams near the DMZ, I know for a fact that we need real pathways to stability on the Korean Peninsula rather than reckless rhetoric that will only endanger the lives of Americans and our South Korean allies. It is time that the international community comes together in order to harness our collective power to let North Korea know that they stand alone against the peaceful nations of the world. Amar Kampa Najjar, another Democratic challenger, is a son of immigrants who escaped war-torn regions. He worked in the U.S. Labor Department and as communications director for the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. He issued the most detailed response to what he called Hunter's immature and premature war with North Korea. Here are excerpts of his remarks. Without any regard for the millions who would die, including Americans living throughout the Pacific, Hunter made the leap from military posturing to calling for nuclear war. Kampa Najjar states, adding, the world is a better place when Americans lead by the power of its example, not the example of its power. He notes that war costs trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives, adding that he would urge restraint from members of Congress and the President because Hunter fails to recognize the dangers of a preemptive strike. It would trigger a nuclear arms race that nobody wants, everyone fears, and not a single soul in the world knows how to end. He observes that even Trump's campaign architect, Steve Bannon, is cautioning against military action. Bannon has said there is no military solution, unless it can be shown that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons. In his KUSI interview, Hunter also suggested the North Koreans might be aiming for Coronado but hit El Cajon. Kampa Najjar notes that El Cajon is home to many war refugees, including Iraqi Christians, who fled ISIS. Invoking El Cajon to justify another war based on assumptions regarding weapons of mass destruction is cruel and manipulative, he says. Kampa Najjar's plan for addressing the North Korean problem includes enhanced military intelligence, a full congressional intelligence briefing to determine if North Korea is capable of targeting the U.S., and exploring options such as crippling North Koreans' abilities through cyber warfare, as well as investing in U.S. missile defense systems to intercept North Koreans' ICBMs, and engaging the international community, notably China, Japan, South Korea, and the United Nations, to help halt South Korea's nuclear aggression. Kampa Najjar concludes, Hunter's rhetoric works against our long-term security and survival as a nation.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on that tense North Korea situation. Monday morning, North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong accused President Trump of declaring war. The top diplomat told media that North Korea reserves the right to shoot down American bomber planes even if they are outside of North Korean airspace. The minister's comments came after Trump's fiery rhetoric at the United Nations warning that he would totally destroy North Korea, and a second inflammatory tweet sent on Sunday warning that Korean leader Kim Jong-un would not be around much longer if he continues threatening to launch nuclear weapons at the United States. The United Nations recently imposed new sanctions on North Korea after the country continued to carry out tests on missiles that may now be capable of reaching the U.S. North Korea's foreign minister, in a Saturday speech to the United Nations, called Trump mentally deranged and said he is on a suicide mission.
A rare moment of bipartisanship is catching on among Western states' members of Congress with a bill to treat wildfires more like other natural disasters. The Wildfire Disaster Funding Act has the support of congressional delegations from Idaho and other Northwest states. Its introduction is timely, as the cost of fighting wildfires in 2017 has already exceeded $2 billion, the most expensive year on record. Government agencies aren't allowed to tap disaster funding to fight these infernos. Will Whelan with the Nature Conservancy in Idaho says this bill would change that.
When we have a particularly severe fire season, the Forest Service and the other public land agencies will be able to access funds available for paying for disasters. And that will help them stabilize their budgets for managing the public's lands.
Whelan says fires have grown more severe in the last few decades, and the Forest Service budget reflects this. In 1995, 15% of its budget went to fighting wildfires. Today, it is 55%, despite the fact that the agency's budget hasn't grown overall. Each year, Congress appropriates money to fight fires on public lands, and that number is based on a 10-year average of firefighting costs. John Roberts is a wildfire mitigation forester in Boise County, the rural county where nearly 190,000 acres of forest land burned in last year's Pioneer Fire. He says the Forest Service has some great tools for fighting fires.
They can get out on the landscape and make a landscape area, forested area, less susceptible to wildfire and more able to control a wildfire. But they can't do that if they're spending all their money fighting the wildfires that they could have prevented if they could do those other things.
Whelan says Idaho has more than 20 million acres of national forest lands that provide Idahoans with water, recreation, and in many cases, a living.
All of those benefits depend on good stewardship, and that's what's at risk as an increasing share of the National Forest Service budget goes to fire suppression. So we need to stabilize the budgets of the agencies that are taking care of our public lands.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
On Friday, California Secretary of State Alex Padilla announced, "Today my office was informed for the first time by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security that Russian cyber actors scanned California's internet-facing systems in 2016. California was among 21 states notified of Russia's attempt to hack their election systems before the 2016 presidential election. The foreign hackers scanned California's systems seeking weakness in a computer network, similar to a burglar looking for unlocked doors in a house," Padilla explained. "The intrusion is troubling since, despite California's cybersecurity protections that include routine monitoring, the state did not detect the break-in. However, Homeland Security confirmed that they have no evidence that any systems were actually penetrated or compromised," the Secretary of State adds. Padilla faulted the federal government for taking over a year to report the hack attempts, noting that withholding such critical information from election officials amounts to, quote, "a detriment to the security of our elections and our democracy." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Archie Moore was the longest reigning world light heavyweight champion of all time from 1952 to 1962. He also trained other boxing greats, including Muhammad Ali, James Tillis, and George Foreman. Now his son, Billy Moore, a San Diego resident, is carrying on the family's boxing tradition as president of the ABC Youth Foundation, which stands for Any Body Can. The foundation runs boxing and youth enrichment programs, as well as a campaign to gather 1 million punches to punch out racism, gang violence, and mistrust of the police. Earlier this month, that campaign came to the Heartland Fire and Rescue Department Station 6 in El Cajon for a 2-day Million Punches from the Heart event. El Cajon's police and fire chiefs participated, along with many firefighters, peace officers, probation department staff, and the Cajon Valley School District Superintendent. Around 135 students and the principal of Lexington Elementary School also joined in. One police cadet threw 911 punches, leading to shouts of, "Hey, Balboa!" a reference to title character Rocky Balboa in the movie Rocky. The novice boxers punched boxing bags for 60 seconds. Each of their punches was counted toward the 1 million goal. Lexington Elementary's principal, Jeremy Leisch, said, "This is a fantastic event. It's a great way to show the fire department and law enforcement in a positive light." San Diego County Probation Department's Deputy Chief, Lorraine Fernandez, spoke to the attendees. "We are really looking forward to referring more of our youth to ABC to keep them out of the system," she said. Billy Moore sees his mission as saving youths from gangs and training them to box through his foundation, which is headquartered on Market Street in San Diego. "We have kids that exceed in life and boxing," he said, adding that the foundation has a boxing gym and also teaches life skills. After the El Cajon event, Moore's Million Punches from the Heart campaign had amassed over 500,000 punches, halfway to his nationwide goal. Next up, he'll be heading to Kansas City, Missouri, taking his 1 million punches from the Heart campaign to America's heartland. To find out more about the campaign or Billy Moore's foundation, you can visit abcyouthfoundation.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Valerie Watts.
Hot, windy weather is forecast for this week, creating elevated fire concerns, the National Weather Service in San Diego advises. The hottest weather will occur in inland valleys with temperatures up to 100 degrees. There will also be gusty offshore winds of up to 35 miles an hour from Monday, continuing through at least Wednesday. So please use caution and avoid activities which may cause sparks to ignite dry grass or brush. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report from La Mesa. The La Mesa City Council will take up several hot issues at its meeting on Tuesday, September 26, at 6 p.m. The council's decision could make it easier for developers to increase density and decrease parking, create new marijuana regulations, and declare La Mesa a ferret-friendly city. A first reading of a draft marijuana ordinance would, among other things, prohibit marijuana use and cultivation in city-owned buildings, except for personal indoor growing in residential property owned by the city. It would also prohibit recreational marijuana-related businesses, but would authorize deliveries of medical marijuana from a dispensary that's authorized under Prop U, which La Mesa voters approved last year. Council will also hear an update on medical and recreational marijuana activities, including closure of several illegal dispensaries and processing of Prop U applications for medical marijuana dispensaries. La Mesa City Council will also consider a proposed draft ordinance adding an affordable homes bonus program to the La Mesa Municipal Code. That's to implement a new state law under Assembly Bill 2501, which requires local governments to provide incentives to developers for projects with affordable homes, and further requires local governments to adopt a local ordinance specifying how compliance with that law will be implemented. The goal of the state law is to increase affordable housing amid a growing affordable housing crisis statewide, including here in San Diego County. However, controversy has arisen in La Mesa, where many residents objected to Silvergate's apartment project at the former Little Flower Haven Convent site. After the developer threatened to sue the city council approved the project over the vocal objections of many neighbors who fear renters will park vehicles on nearby streets, leaving inadequate parking for residents in a neighborhood with older homes and only single-car garages. A council subcommittee has, since January, sought and received input from stakeholders who may propose affordable housing projects, as well as a letter of support from the San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce. It is unclear, however, whether that subcommittee made any effort to obtain input from La Mesa residents, the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce, or other stakeholders in the community beyond developers and a regional chamber based outside of La Mesa. In addition, the City Council will hold a discussion and possible vote on a citizen's request to have La Mesa be declared a ferret-friendly city. Ferret ownership is legal in nearly every U.S. state, but remains illegal in California.
Nile Sisters will host a program on September 28th titled Refugee Crisis, Spotlight on South Sudan, featuring a panel of Southern Sudanese leaders and key stakeholders. The event will be held at the San Diego Foundation Executive Boardroom this Thursday, 3:30 to 5 p.m., and is open to the community, though parental discretion is advised. The South Sudan refugee crisis is the world's fastest-growing yet least talked about population emergency. An estimated 3,500 refugees from Sudan, Darfur, and South Sudan reside in the San Diego region, a key resettlement area for the Lost Boys of Sudan in the early 2000s and current home to around 98 Lost Boys. Elizabeth Liu, NSDI President, CEO, notes that global refugee concerns are of interest to San Diego. She says, the County of San Diego is the largest refugee resettlement site in the state of California. The world is at our door. Panelists at Thursday's event will discuss the founding of the Republic of South Sudan, concerns over ballooning populations of refugees and internally displaced people, as well as the response by international, national, and local entities. Nile Sisters, organizer of the event, provides services to refugees and immigrants in our region, particularly training and education to help women and their families overcome barriers to social and economic self-reliance. For more information on Nile Sisters or on the Refugee Crisis Spotlight on Sudan event, you can visit nilesisters.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Gene Carpenter.
A giant duck-billed creature called Augustinolophus morisi is now California's official state dinosaur. The huge reptile roamed California around 66 million years ago, and its fossilized remains have not been found anywhere else. Nicknamed Augie, the Augustinolophus can be seen in the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles, where the only two skeletons ever discovered are on display. California joins 9 states and the District of Columbia in adopting an official state dinosaur. Governor Jerry Brown made the state dinosaur proclamation when he signed a bill into law authored by Assemblyman Richard Bloom from Santa Monica. Assemblyman Bloom created an official Twitter account, @Augustinolophus, to lobby for Augie as the state's dinosaur because he tweeted, "Augie is a native Californian, Los Angeles resident, older than Jerry Brown, barely, vegetarian, and firm believer in science." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this was Miriam Raftery. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Fall is the season for visiting Julian, a historic gold rush town nestled in East County, known for its apple days. So we thought this would be a good time to replay one of our best of East County favorites, taking you on the road to Julian.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town. Since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who were the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret, because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek, and that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long, and so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and that's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old, and this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
so these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
us?
Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist. S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary, and it's hard, and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pic that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know.
Hit a hunch, maybe.
Not Drury. Drury This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People are out there trying to get lucky. But, say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Jaden.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot harder.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right,
and those folks, and we just did a, Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and right, you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple of pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the ridges. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold is heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it. Steven,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold, and the techniques by Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually worked.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way
you're
that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka.
Eureka. You're gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T. It's a cluster puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now, remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet. Yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to Yupik apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie, so we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes, got promoted to cooking, because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, September 25th, 2017. I'm Mary Sherman. Here's a look at what we're highlighting. New travel restrictions announced for 8 countries. Research highlights a drop in uninsured kids, and weekend protests over the House Speaker's tax plan. At the top of the list, President Trump is replacing his controversial travel ban with a targeted list of restrictions that will enhance vetting for nationals from 8 countries. Officials on Sunday announced the 8 countries on the modified list are Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen, maintaining that the restrictions are based in an objective worldwide review, not based on origin or religion. Authorities say these states failed to comply with the U.S. information sharing requirements that aim to make vetting processes stronger. The country saw the number of uninsured children drop to historic lows in 2016, according to a new report. We get more from Eric Tagadoff in South Dakota.
The Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found fewer than 5% of children nationwide are uninsured. Dr. Nicole Poppinga is president of the South Dakota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Both she and the Georgetown report cite the important roles of the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, and the latter could expire at the end of the month.
There's many families very concerned that they could lose CHIP and that their children would not have health care coverage. Families that have children with disabilities, and they're very concerned that Medicaid coverage changes could make it very difficult for them to afford medical care for their children.
Congress has until September 30th to renew funding for CHIP.
And on Sunday, President Trump left open the possibility that the latest Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act might not be successful, despite likely plans to vote on the GOP proposal this week. The president also noted that his first priority has been on overhauling the tax code, and he told reporters that the tax plan he and lawmakers will propose has been totally finalized.
Meanwhile, Boston kicked this weekend off with protests of U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan's budget resolution. It calls for $5.5 trillion in tax cuts and is expected to reach the House floor by early October. Mike Clifford reports.
Among those speaking out in opposition to the Ryan plan is Michael Caine, who heads the Massachusetts Alliance of HUD Tenants. Caine took part in an action on Friday at the Bank of America building to highlight how the cuts will benefit large corporations like BOA that Caine says have avoided paying U.S. taxes by parking billions in profits offshore.
Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell are about to rush through tax breaks to billionaires and large corporations that will blow a hole in the federal budget for years to come, and it would force cuts to Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid.
Cutting taxes remains the GOP's top priority, although Republican lawmakers have yet to agree on whether to offset them with cuts by cutting spending or closing tax loopholes or both.
A rare moment of bipartisanship is catching on among Western states' members of Congress with a bill to treat wildfires more like other natural disasters. The Wildfire Disaster Funding Act has the support of congressional delegations from Idaho and other Northwest states. Its introduction's timely, as the cost of fighting wildfires in 2017 has already exceeded $2 billion, the most expensive year on record. Government agencies aren't allowed to tap disaster funding to fight these infernos. Will Whalen with the Nature Conservancy says this bill would change that.
When we have a particularly severe fire season, the Forest Service and the other public land agencies will be able to access funds available for paying for disasters. And that will help them stabilize their budgets for managing the public's lands.
Whalen says fires have grown more severe in the last few decades, and the Forest Service budget reflects this. In 1995, 15% of its budget went to fighting wildfires. Today, it's 55%, despite the fact that the agency's budget hasn't grown overall. As Hurricane Maria continues to march north, tropical storm watches have been issued for the entire North Carolina coast and parts of the extreme southern end of the Virginia coast. The forecast track for Maria hasn't changed much, with the storm still expected to remain offshore but sideswipe coastal locations with tropical storm conditions beginning on Tuesday. As Florida cities wrestle with how to haul millions of tons of post-hurricane debris and where to put it, the environmental community is asking whether the storms will prompt a turning point in the state's reputation for minimizing the issue of climate change.
Despite Florida's vulnerability to sea level rise and extreme weather events, state employees are discouraged from using the terms climate change and global warming. But Ken Berlin, who heads up the Climate Reality Project, founded by Al Gore, says the state has gotten the ultimate wake-up call.
The key thing about climate change is you can't hide from it. You may be able to hide from it for a while, but you can't hide from things like Harvey and Irma. And you can sort of for a while say, well, I don't believe it, but the evidence is becoming stronger every day.
Now, he says, it's important for Floridians to take steps that show they are paying attention. They can ask policymakers to spend disaster relief dollars on more resilient infrastructure designed to withstand the effects of a warming climate. I'm Tramell Gomes.
In health news, a catastrophic sleep misfortune plagues causing a large group of possibly fatal diseases. That according to Matthew Walker, executive of the Center for Human Sleep Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He said, electric lights, TV, computer screens, longer drives, the obscuring of the line among work and individual time have been added to sleep hardship, which is characterized as under 7 hours per night. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. Hi, this is Connie again, and I'm talking to you about what you should be thinking about planting now. And in another couple of weeks, you better not be thinking about it. You better be doing it. So what do we start with in the fall? You think green. Think of all those greens that you love to eat, because this is the time to get them in the ground. Asian greens, mustard greens, spinach, and my favorite, beet greens. Except you get a double payoff with beets. In fact, you get about a 5 or 6 payoff with beets, because every little beet seed that you are planting actually is an old dried up flower, and it contains 5 or 6 seeds in it. So when those beets come up, you've probably wondered in the past, why, if I only planted one beet there, do I have 5 little plants there?
What you can do is wait until they get to be about 2 inches tall, and then, using your very most delicate touch, wet the soil and carefully, using your fingers on the leaves, pull out those extras. Leave the biggest one in place, pull the others, and immediately replant them 3 or 4 inches away from the mother plant, or start another row, but get them a ways away from each other so that they will each have room to grow. As they grow, you can enjoy pulling off an occasional big leaf and stir-frying it or cooking it up, braising it in a pan. They're my favorite greens, like I said. Eventually, much later, you will end up with full-grown beet roots that you can pull out and cook. So now's the time to start your beets. What else can you start now? Broccoli, everything in the cabbage family, kale plants. Pull the old ones from last year that are dried up over the summer. Get some new kale going. You can start cilantro now, and you will have to replant it again in about 2 months because cilantro doesn't last forever. It goes to flower too soon. But at this time of year, with the cooler days and nights, it takes longer for it to bolt into flower. So cilantro is a great thing to grow right now. Right now, I just started my peas. I use Chinese edible pod peas, but any kind of peas can be started now. What you want to do is soak those seeds overnight or even for 48 hours and then plant them. Poke them into wet soil, get them down about an inch or so, inch and a half, cover them well. And I want to mention, when all these seeds that you plant, the smaller the seed, the closer to the surface you plant it. And always press down hard. Annie's Annuals up in Richmond is run by a delightful woman who talks about how she started her first batch of annual plants. She planted them outdoors in flats. The seed flats were right there. She was so upset because her cat ran across the seed flats when she was through planting them. What happened was those were the only seeds that came up. So that was a lesson to her, and it's a lesson to all of us. Press down on the soil after your seeds are in the ground so you have good contact as well as the moisture, so things will start early. You can grow radishes year-round. You can start scallions and green onions right now. Swiss chard, I would suggest that you get that in the ground right away, hopefully by the 1st of October, because Swiss chard likes the warm soil to start. In fact, all of these seeds like the warm soil to start, and then they appreciate the cooler days as they grow and get larger.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Jonathan Getz reporting in La Mesa. Bugsy's Brew Coffee Shop has closed its doors 5 years after opening at the corner of La Mesa Boulevard and Jackson Drive. Bugsy's became a popular gathering place not only for coffee aficionados, but also musicians and music fans who came to enjoy local talent on open mic nights. A note taped to the door informs customers of the closing over the weekend with a heavy heart but great memories. Owner Dan Moran thanked patrons, adding, "I'm sorry for having to move on, but my family is in need and I just focus on remaining active in my children's lives. Family first forever." East County Magazine interviewed Moran back in 2012 when the Java Joint had just opened with a slogan, "So good it should be illegal." Coffee drinks were named after famous gangsters such as Al Capone, Lucky Luciano, and Ma Barker. Moran said he named the place after his grandfather, George Bugs Moran, who ran Chicago bootlegging operations during Prohibition. His gang was gunned down in the notorious St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929, reportedly on the orders of Al Capone. But ironically, Bugs Moran's life was spared thanks to a coffee shop. Now his grandson's coffee shop, too, is relegated to the realm of history. You can view photos of the final night's open mic performances on September 16, 2017, on the Facebook photo album, The Last Night at Bugsy's. Linda Neiman, a longtime patron of Bugsy's, was there for the closing night. She posted on Facebook, 'Twas a sad evening, so hard to say goodbye to Bugsy's and all the good times we've had there.
Recreational use of marijuana in California has been legalized by voters, but smoking or consuming marijuana in any form while driving or riding in vehicles will be illegal in California starting January 1st, 2018, under Senate Bill 65, just signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. Santa Clara District Attorney Jeff Rosen says there is nothing recreational, medicinal, or legal about hurting someone in a car accident when you're high. The bill adds marijuana consumption to the law prohibiting alcohol consumption on the road, which is an infraction currently punishable with a base fine of $70. Having an open container of marijuana in a vehicle is also illegal under a previously passed measure. The new law responds to concerns about an increase in stone drivers. In 2012, the California Office of Traffic Safety released a study of weekend nighttime drivers that found more California motorists tested positive for marijuana than alcohol. In addition, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, from 2007 to 2014, the number of nighttime weekend drivers in the U.S. with marijuana in their system increased nearly 50%. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter. It's back to the drawing board for San Diego County Library officials, who had planned to debut an automated library kiosk in front of the old fire station in Rural Boulevard. It was supposed to dispense books and other materials 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But now a heavy cover is over the darkened kiosk, and Boulevard residents must wait at least until mid-December before it will be operational. Why? Because while library officials invested in advanced technology for their innovative kiosk program, they failed to take into account the extreme weather conditions in Boulevard. It turns out that in spite of the stylish shelter which surrounds the kiosk, sunlight hitting the kiosk during the day makes it too hot to touch or even come close to the structure. In addition, dust whipped up by Santa Ana winds in this rural community end up inside the kiosk, gumming up the works. The county library operates its kiosks throughout San Diego at a cost of $300,000 apiece. The kiosks allow users to check out and return books from any county library, browse through around 340 books and movies in stock, reserve books through the library system's catalog, and pay fines on materials. The kiosks also double as Wi-Fi hotspots and allow anyone nearby with a library card and laptop to go online. Librarians used a dedicated software system to pick what materials are likely to be popular at the different kiosks, including not only books but also DVDs and audiobooks. The county library promises it will host a grand opening event at its Boulevard kiosk whenever the heat and dust problems are resolved. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.